Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
What's better than a fall weekend in Vermont? That's right, absolutely nothing. The HRN team had the pleasure of attending Shacks Camp in early October, and we haven't stopped talking about it since we got back. Shacks Camp is a weekend filled with foraging for wild apples, frolicking in orchards, eating cheese, and celebrating cider, all hosted by the wonderful team at Shacksbury Cider. We stayed at the historic Sunrise Orchards Farmhouse in Cornwall, Vermont, but our adventures took us all over the Champlain Valley. I'm Jordan Werner, and in this episode of HRN On Tour, I'm sharing Shacks Camp highlights, both the educational and the slightly intoxicated. The adventures begin at Windfall Orchards in Cornwall with Brad Kaler. Brad is the owner and cider maker at Windfall Orchards, but he's also a chef and an accidental orchardist. When Brad and his wife, Amy Trubeck, bought this 3-acre orchard in 2002, it was abandoned, 7 years overgrown, and in terrible shape. We're walking around the orchard with Brad to learn how he cleared it up and what's going on in the trees now.
We collaborate quite a bit, us and Shacksbury. One of the things that we're doing is, you may be familiar with their Lost Apple Project, where they've gone around and sort of sought out these apples. Most of what they have found are chance seedlings, chance seedling being a wild apple tree. And they've given them names. And so I think there's a collection of 10 of the Shacksbury fruit that we have grafted into the orchard that we're trialing and just seeing, you know, how quickly they come to fruit, how the fruit set is, disease management, all that sort of thing. So we're in the middle of that project. We started that with them about 3 years ago. So we're probably a little over halfway done, maybe two-thirds of the way done picking for the season. We have a lot of late-season fruit that you'll still see on the tree. We'll pick for about another month. We'll pick right into early November, the last few varieties. So talk a little bit, and they may get more into it, Shacksbury. So the Champlain Valley, which is where we're at here, is the historic apple-growing region for Vermont. And they've been growing apples in this region for over 200 years. Most of the, if you're lucky, going back to the Lost Apple Project, a lot of where what they're looking for are old homesteads up in the mountains, where people may have had trees planted for cider 100 plus years ago, and those orchards have been abandoned, and those that fruit may it still exist. There's been a long history and culture of growing apples specifically for cider in this area, for hard cider. So why don't we take a little walk through, and then we'll come back up and then we'll go in the tasting room and I'll pull out what cold bottles I have and we'll give a taste.
So. Let's do it.
So here, we'll stop here. These are some trees we've started. These are grafted over. This is a Macintosh here. And you can see where the graft is. These are now golden russet.
Oh, cool.
And this is the first fruit. These grafts are, these were put in last year. So we've got fruit within 1 year of the grafts being put in. So we can get the fruit really quickly. So compared to, say, cutting the tree down and planting a new tree, you know, we have this beautiful tree that we can keep utilizing for many years. So that's why we're doing a lot of this grafting. It's a lot of work. And there's a very small window, only about 2-week window in the spring that you can do the work. So we get done as much as we possibly can do, and then we wait till the next year and do more. So.
And were these Mac trees here when you...
These Mac trees, yeah. So these were planted, these old Macs were planted in the 40s. And they, you know, they're virtually you know, I don't want to say worthless, but they have very little value compared to Wixen or Tabinet or, you know, other fruit that I could sell for a lot more money.
What's your breakdown varietal-wise? Like, do you have something you're growing the majority of, or is it kind of mixed?
Well, Macintosh.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm desperately trying to change that equation. So all the Macintosh trees in the lower section, we have finished grafting. So here's an example. This was a Macintosh tree, and now it produces Major, which is an early season English cider fruit. So that's been picked. So the tree I'm going to show you down in the corner, this is one of the trees that we're playing with some of the Shaxberry fruit. So you can see there's a bunch of different stuff here. So there's three very distinct apples. This one they call Animal Farm. The little yellow one up top, which is as bitter as hell, is Sawmill. And then this red one is Cutting Hill. And these are starting to jump. If you want to taste something really disgusting.
Yes.
Like you want to spit this sucker out, man. This is like... These are so bitter. You're going to... I've got more, don't worry.
It's so cute.
Those are different.
Oh!
How does it taste?
It's a lot going on.
It grows on you.
It is. There's a couple more here.
It's got a nice woody flavor.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of tannin in there.
These are barely... very oaky.
That's the most tannic of the... apples, and then here's a couple others. If you want. Those are gross.
This one. This one's more.
Same apple.
That one's sweeter.
Not bad.
I'll pass a couple of these around. Again, these aren't really eating apples. These are the Shaxberry cider apples that I'm working with.
Thanks.
So you can see how quickly this fruit comes in, and we only did these grafts 3 years ago, 2000.
Really
dumb. Oh, maybe it's
been a long. Supposed to spit
your apple. These grafts are about 4 years old now. Got dates on there. 2014, yeah. So you can see in 3 years how much fruit's coming off of those.
Do you ever have grafts that aren't successful?
Yes.
What's like the rate?
In a good year, 75-80% success. Cool. In a not so good year, maybe 40-50%. So we got, this is, some of the varieties. So this is, these were all done in 2014, so within 3 years. I think those dwarf trees were put in 13 or 14. So you can see why I would choose this over that in terms of how quickly, why cut this tree down in 3 years I can have it producing all of this fruit.
Freak tree.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got, this has 10 different varieties grafted on it. And there are four of them. One, two, three, four. There's actually five varieties that have fruit this year. And some of the grafts are probably a year from producing fruit.
Is there a limit to how many you'd put on one tree, or as many branches as
there? As many as there are branches. We're going to 10, 12, 15, whatever.
Will it change the flavor of the other varieties?
No. Typically not. Now, depending on the rootstock, that may play a role in how the form of the tree and whatnot. So,
what's the actual process for grafting? What do you have to do to prepare?
So let's take a look at this. This is a good look at the graft. So basically, here's the original branch, and we would have cut the branch here, and you can see where we split it. See that split open there? So we have a tool that splits that open. And then we take the scion wood, which basically looks like this. It's a piece of wood, 1 year growth, just like this. And see the buds, 1, 2, 3. I do have my knife with me. So just to give you a quick tutorial. So we would have our scion wood, which would look like this. And then we would... we would trim this down. So it's basically like tree surgery. And if you can see here, what we've done by trimming this down is I've exposed the cambium layer right there. Can you see that? The cambium layer of the wood there. And so then when I go to put this in, so I've got this split, the cambium layer on the tree is right here, so I try to put those in and line those up. So the cambium layer from the scion and the cambium layer from the host line up. And I've got two of them, one here and one here. And then I've got this tool which leaves that propped open. When I pull that out, the tension closes, and then I wax the whole thing over, the wound. So you can see the little green wax, it's remnants of that. So here's one where there would have been two. This got some fire blight, unfortunately. That's why it looks like it does. There's one, there's two. We usually do two. Here's another one. One, two. This is one. This one didn't make it. This one I've got to cut off. So we always do two, in case one doesn't make it. Here's one where there's two. And what I'll do eventually as they grow is I'll come in and then trim one of them out so that we've got one good branch coming. So that's a quick tutorial. And if you guys are bored and have nothing to do in March, you can come and help us grow.
We'll be here.
So. Do the same apples on different trees mature at the same rate, or does...
Depends on the variety. So they'll hold true the variety. So in the trees, so the one up top there, I've got a variety called St. Lawrence, which is ready in August. Mm-hmm. And then I've got a variety called Spitzenberg, which isn't ready for another week. So the August apples come in August. We pick them, and then the branch is empty, but then the rest of them are there.
So that make it much harder to keep track of everything?
Yes. That's why, that's why most of the trees that we graft are like this, where we take and we graft the entire tree to be the same variety. I mean, they're fun to look at with all the different, but they're bitched. Sorry. So here's a tree. This is a good example. So, I mean, this is actually breaking branches, so heavy. We did this tree, we started this tree in 2011. This is the first tree we started grafting. And so you can see, every single branch on the tree has been grafted over. The entire tree now produces a fruit that it never produced before. This is an Arkansas black. And so again, you can see the difference between keep a dwarf, put a dwarf tree in, or graft over. So this is 11, 12. You know, this is 5, 6 years. And the one over here, which is Windfall Golden, is the same. We've grafted over every branch. And now we've got a full harvest of fruit from those trees.
It's a good thing Brad has plenty of them, because the Windfall Golden is a very special apple indeed.
So this is the original, that's the Windfall Golden. That's the tree, that's the chance seedling tree that we grafted. They're not ripe for another 3 weeks or so, and they taste like pears. They're really amazing.
There's no grafted. That's the tree,
and it's a chance seedling. And
can you explain a little bit what that is?
That is sure. Yeah. So apples are heterozygous. So what that means is they don't bear true to seed. So in their cross, during the pollination. There's a cross-pollination, and so the seed in the apple doesn't produce the apple. So if I took the seed from that apple, it'd produce something completely different as a result of the pollination cross. So every seed of every apple potentially produces a different tree, a different fruit, a different variety. Overwhelming majority of them are terrible. And I'm worthless. You do it by taste.
Yeah.
And about one every 10,000 trees might produce a decent fruit. And so we got lucky in this one. This happened to be growing here. It was buried with a bunch of weeds and sumac, and we cut it out. And there was an area here where the previous owner would plant he would put the compost from the press, and then he'd germinate the seeds, and he'd get those trees growing, and then he'd graft basically onto the wild rootstock named varieties. And so my hypothesis is that this was a wild tree that was planted, eventually meant to be grafted, and never was.
And that's what it is today. Because all the other, a lot of the other trees were grafted in here, but not this one.
One man's compost is another man's treasure.
Exactly. You got it. So, just a fabulous variety that's unique to here. We sent some Cyan Wood over to John Bunker at, up in Maine at Fedco. And so he has that in his catalog now. So you can get, not every year, but many years he's got these. You can buy the little trees.
Amazing. Looking around the orchard, it's easy to see that Brad and his crew are in high harvest mode. The Windfall Goldens are still hanging on, but plenty of apple and pear trees have already lightened their loads.
This orchard, I mean, I'll be honest with you, it's a small orchard. This orchard's really built more than anything else to be beautiful. You know, it is more beautiful than practical when it comes to management.
How do you harvest?
One at a time.
Cool.
By hand. Oh, yeah. One at a time. Two if they fit in the hand.
Depending on how big your hands are.
Depending on how big your hands are and how many you can get. These are one at a time. Big ones. So why don't we head up over to the tasting room.
Yeah.
And see what I have in my fridge.
Brad must be reading our minds. This crew is thirsty. And all this apple talk has us ready to taste the finished products.
How many do I have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10.
We're all sober.
Is everybody trying?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So the first thing we're going to try is the Orleans, which is herbal aperitif, made to be similar to a Lillet, and is flavored with basil. Yes. Flavored with basil and anise hyssop. And I'll explain the production method of this here in a minute. So the way I like to drink the herbal aperitif hot summer day, it's not quite a hot summer day, but it's still good, on ice with club soda and lime. It's really great. It's a cocktail mixer with vodka and gin. So to jump ahead, we'll talk a little bit about the ice cider making process, to talk about this process. So with the ice cider, we store our apples and we press them in January. And we put all the juice in 300-gallon totes and we stick them outside in the 10 below zero weather that we have here typically. Not every winter these days, but most winters freezes out within 3-4 weeks. And we bring that frozen 300-gallon cider cube into the winery and start thawing it. And the sugars, which are denser than water, thaw first. So we basically get an extraction of sugar from the ice. And it's about a 20% yield. So we melt off to about 36 bricks for the fermentation of our ice cider. There's still sugar left in that cube. And so what we do is we refreeze it, bring it back in. We thaw it again. We get some sugar, but at a much lower bricks. And so that second melt, we get to about 18 bricks, and then we ferment that completely dry, which we use as the base for the Orleans. So in a sense, first melt, second melt. Mm-hmm. Trying to get a little bit more value out of it's a, you know, it's just, it's expensive enough, and if we can just capture a little bit something else out of it. So have you bring your cups. So we'll move on to the hard cider. I will. Oh my god, it's like champagne. It really is, you know, when we open it, because we do a method champenoise. It's a naturally conditioned in the bottle. It's really lovely bubbles.
I think that held up pretty well, actually.
So with our hard cider, we blend of about 30 different varieties of apples. And did I get everybody? We do a very traditional English style. We do wild yeast fermentations, spontaneous fermentation. It's conditioned for about a year before we bottle it. And then when we bottle it, we use our ice cider as the dosage for the secondary fermentation. So there's no added sugar anywhere along the process. And you might even pick up a tiny bit of that ice cider at the very back of the palate when the finish of this cider. Cheers, everybody.
Are you getting the yeast from the apples?
Yes. Yeah. So it's natural yeast that's on the apples in the cider house. So.
That
one
tastes good.
It's been a long day. It's been a long week. And there's more of it.
For the cider?
I could tell you.
But there's still
no. It's a mix of 30, and it's about half and half. Half late season heirloom dessert fruits, so things like golden russet, Spitzenberg, Rhode Island greenings, and half English cider fruits: Wixen, Dabinet, Yarlington Mill, Somerset Red, Major, Harry Masters.
I got
a couple. And then we, now that we have the Shaxberry fruit, we're going to be putting some of that in as well. So, yeah. So help yourself. Just finish it.
Okay.
I can't use it for anything else.
The bottle got away from me.
It's so good.
And then we'll go on to dessert. So, and this is our 2016. We just released it a couple weeks ago.
Are you holding anything back in aging some of your ciders?
Yes and no. So our hard cider, as much as I'd love to, it just sells. I mean, we don't make a lot of it. We only make about 250 cases. And so it's, you know, usually it's sold out. This year we actually managed to not sell it out before the release of the next year, which is, was really quite an accomplishment this year. Usually we like sell out in May and then the shelves are empty, which retailers hate, until September. So we finally got that in line. The ice cider, we're going to try a 2012, of which I think I only have 5 bottles left.
Yeah.
And then the 2013, we're also going to try. And then and I've got some of that in cellar, the 2013. So we'll be selling that for a bit, and we'll allow that to age. And then our 2016 ice cider is still in the tank. We haven't bottled that one yet. So, ice cider.
Step up.
So we're going to start with the 13, and sorry, the pour is going to be kind of small on this because I want to make this little bit get to everybody. I'll make the 2012 a little bigger pour. So this is the 13, and you will tell the difference between the 13 and 12, and I'll talk to you a little bit about where those differences come from. The blend of the apples is pretty similar year to year. Is that everybody? Okay. So with the ice cider, we blend again about 30 different varieties of apples. All late season heirloom dessert fruits. It's all no cider fruit per se, more sweet fruit. The 2013 was a really big vintage year, a big harvest year, a lot of fruit, beautiful fruit. Made a lot of beautiful ice cider. The 13 is still holding on to a little bit of acidity. So one of the things you'll notice when we get to 2012, there's the acid levels have dropped a little bit. And so as the ice cider's age, the acid levels drop. The perceived sweetness increases, though the residual sugar is identical. The other thing that happens over time is you can see with the color, a little bit of microoxidation happens, and that allows the flavor to sort of turn to a bit more caramel apple. The other note about 2012 versus 2013, 2012 was a really horrible apple year. And we had a late frost and there was not a lot of fruit, but the fruit we had was very concentrated. It was really an amazing vintage. So I think 2012 was probably the best vintage we've made of the ice cider because of that concentration of fruit. And 16 was similar to 12. And so our 2016 tastes really great. Very much, it's got a ways to go to be this, but it's similar. So 2012, for those who want 2012.
Thank you.
And as far as cider in general, do you think there is a future in trying to age it? Like
hard cider? Or,
yeah, like cellaring and playing with older vintage.
Possibly. I would say 99% of the cider that's produced in this country is made to be drunk almost immediately.
What varieties of cider, if
so, like,
do you think would be better for?
Oh, for aging?
Or that there's a few.
So you would. So the craft produced ciders of ourselves and Shaxbury and Farnham Hill and. Those ciders that are made with apples that have tannin, the tannin is the key. So if you've got a craft-made cider with a good amount of tannin, you can age that. And I think, you know, to me personally, I think a well-structured cider is best when it's between 2 and 3 years old. And we try not to sell anything before at least a year, you know, because it takes at least a year for things to start to come together. And then I think the 16 will taste even that much better a year from now when we're sold out. Apples. It should taste like apples.
I mean, it definitely comes through in your products.
Like, yeah, it's very clean. We do very clean.
Yeah, it's like celebrating what's just there.
That's right. I'm a chef. We just take the best ingredients and make them speak for themselves.
Could you show us how you press it or where you press
sure.
it?
Sure. It's out in the barn.
Cool.
Yep, so we can take a walk up there.
The pressing barn at Windfall Orchards isn't far from the tasting room. It's just across the lawn. When we get there, we see a big walk-in cooler, which prompts Brad to share a little more about the rules of ice cider production and our neighbors to the Nord.
Why wouldn't you just freeze the juice for the ice cider in a walk-in, and why do you do it outside?
So we follow the Quebec standard, and the Quebec standard, in order to be called ice cider, it has to be done naturally. So there are producers who do it mechanically, but you can't use the term ice cider. So the term ice cider, it's like champagne, or there's a protocol of what you have to do and how you have to follow it. And so for ice cider, it has to be between 8 and 13% alcohol, has to be at least, I think, 12% residual sugar. There has to be at least 10% residual acidity, and you have to freeze it naturally. So there are parameters for that.
Is that regulated in the U.S. too, or just in Canada?
There's a handful of us producers, and we've been able to basically impact that at the DL, at the TTB. So we were able to get the TTB to create that as a condition for the labeling, so that, you know, if you want to have the ice cider label, you have to follow these conditions, so...
Right by the pressing barn door, there's a big stack of crates, filled with pears, destined for Brad's elusive and delicious Perry. The whole place is abuzz.
It smells so good.
Should have been here yesterday. It was like thousands and thousands of yellow jackets.
Wow.
Like, it was insane. We were pressing yesterday.
Yeah.
So this is our humble press setup. The apples, what we do is we wash the apples here. And then they get fed in. I know this is all covered. They get fed into this hopper, and this is an elevator. Brings the apples up, and then there's a piece that goes over this. This is the grinding wheel. It spins, shreds them into mush. And underneath here is the press. This is what the press looks like. So it's a bladder press. So just come take a look. There's a bladder in here. And we hook that up to air, and that fills. So there's a cloth that are in the sink. They go inside, and this fills up with all the apple mash. And we screw the top back on, and we hook the air hose up to it, and then we inflate this... a bladder very slowly, and as that inflates, it pushes the mash up against the wall, and all the juice comes running out.
How much? Can you use bladder presses, or are bladder presses used for other fruits as well, aside from pears, apples?
You've seen the. It's fairly new that you're seeing them in cider. Mm-hmm. They've been used in winemaking for quite a while. Europeans have been using them for a number of years. These are made in Slovenia, and they're pretty ingenious, and they're relatively inexpensive compared to them.
We're hugely grateful to Brad Kaler of Windfall Orchards for showing us around, pressing some knowledge into our brains, and sharing his spectacular ciders. Armed with our newfound know-how from Brad, we spent Saturday morning foraging for wild apples with the Shaxbury crew in Rutland, Vermont. And while the downtown of Rutland is known more for its seedy characters than its chance seedlings, we had a great time shaking trees and helping harvest. After all our hard work, it's time for a spritz or two. So we're heading to Vergennes to check out Shaxbury Cider's new digs. Shaxbury kills it on the hospitality front, largely thanks to partner Luke Schmucker and his camp counselor-like ways. It's probably a lot harder to wrangle a group of cider fanatics after a few glasses of Arlo than it is to get tweens to show up at a campfire sing, but Luke does it all with ease. More than that, he keeps pouring barrel samples.
This is this year's 2017 fruit. I'm just going to give you a big pour and divvy it out.
Sure.
Or just drink it.
Or just drink it all.
We'll all get your herpes.
It's not fermented dry yet. Obviously, there's still RS in it, but it'll give you an idea. Spread some love.
Love that RS.
Yeah, embrace the RS.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is some Vermont cheese.
Oh, you want some Whistlepig barrel aged?
Yes.
Yes. Just do tank pours of everything.
Why you came here.
I'm not sure it's all right before I give it to you. All right, let's just, you're good. You're in good hands.
Thanks. How long has this been?
It's juice from last year. We try not to put them in the barrels for too long because they have such a strong rye character that we don't want it to be overwhelming, so we want to be able to taste the apple. A lot of the high tannin fruit does really well in barrels, so some of the Dabinet. Yeah. I'm going to pour everyone a little bit of this, and then we'll wander upstairs.
And I know you did the Golden Russet single varietal.
Yes.
And the Dabinet.
Yes.
Are those the only ones you've done so far?
I got the blurry hand, which is good.
Golden Russet, Dabinet. We've done single origin wild forage ciders before, like Twig.
Yeah.
Like Twig Cuvée from Michael Lee's property. So we've done more of those, but again, it's seedlings and you're getting a bunch of different stuff, but it's from a singular location, and that's pretty cool to see that. But it's hard to do a lot of single varietals because you want to get that complexity and build it. Dabinet's a special apple, so it works really well. But
is there anything else you're growing that you think will lend itself to that?
I think so. We'll find out how well. I mean, as far as the apples that we're propagating, they're doing really well. It's a matter of once we put them into fermentation in separate tanks and see how they work out, because, again, being a small company, you have a limited amount of fermentation tanks, as you can see, so a lot of it is pre-blending based on taste and then blending again before bottling to find out really where you want your cider to go.
Shaxbury is about to have the grand opening of their brand new tasting room in Vergennes, Vermont. We got a sneak peek of the beautifully finished tasting room and the more historic parts of the rest of the old creamery building.
This was an old creamery, right?
Yes, true story.
The first time I came down here was when you guys were doing the loading dock.
Yes, the loading dock lounge.
Yeah.
Space heaters, just keeping it rustic.
Yep.
Sign's still up.
Yeah.
We made a tiny little tasting room that was like, we have this now, and next on the list is figuring out what to do.
We have this now.
We have this. Yeah. And we have all this.
The building's upstairs is massive. Big enough to make us briefly consider bowling with apples. But Shaxbury's director of sales, Alex Gonsalvo, convinces us it's a waste of good apples. He tells us more about how Shaxbury ended up in this big old building.
So, it was pretty dormant for, I don't know, 30 years. Anyway. Then we came and said, we're going to throw apples everywhere. It's going to be awesome.
How did you find the space originally?
Colin just like got his nose in here, just like sniffing around. He's like, this looks. Colin is our resident architect too, so like he sees places like this and has vision. And then like I'm like, no, dude, it's too gross. And then after he clears all the shit away, it's like, oh, I get it. You know, like, this is a gem. Good job. Because no one else really saw it. This was empty for, like, a long time, though. Mm-hmm. Not anymore.
That's
yeah.
We found one of these.
Now it's full of dudes with hula hoops and apples.
Do you know the history of the creamery?
Colin does. Stick that microphone in his face.
Creamery, blah, blah, blah.
No.
Colin Davis, who Alex describes as a sneaky yet knowledgeable fellow, is one of Shaxbury Cider's two co-founders. When we find him, he's wearing chemistry goggles, throwing apples into a growling machine.
I suppose I just stopped making noise, huh? It was built in, not sure exactly, 1909, I think, or 07, one of the two, as a creamery. So it was like a consolidation point for a lot of dairy farmers around here. So they would deliver their milk. There was like a structure out front that doesn't exist anymore, and then it would get packaged and get put on the rail, which is, you probably saw, yeah, and go down to Boston, I think, primarily. So it was that until like the 40s or 50s maybe, and then it turned into they manufactured like wooden things, bowls, I don't know, like household, like paper towel holders, I don't even know what, kind of like random knickknacks, there you go, that's the word I'm looking for. Then it was empty, and it was kind of like it was a touristy place. There was a passenger rail that ran back here, and people would get off, come down here, buy fudge and wooden bowls, get back on the train, boom, out. And then it was, I think it was empty for a couple decades, maybe. And I think they would use it for, like, random events, fundraisers. When we first came in here, it was completely full of stuff for like a tag sale fundraiser, you know, so just like random crap from people's garages.
Yeah. And how'd you find the building?
We were just looking for something that come out here. We were looking for a space that spoke to us in a community that we liked, and so I guess, you know, that's sort of where we started. We really like Virgin's. We like the sort of energy here, and the restaurant scene is good. And then this building, I've driven by a million times, never came in here, but initially really liked the owners and could sort of envision being in the space. We liked that it was an agricultural building to start off with, and that the bones were beautiful, even if it was pretty shabby. So basically what we've done in the first floor here is just, it was covered in, like, all the walls had barn board over it. Some of the ceiling did. There was like a big, like, checkout counter thing down the middle. So we basically just, like, ripped everything off. And then put some plumbing in.
Great.
Yeah. So, kind of like our test kitchen. Yeah. So our specialty stuff, like that, this press it's like 1/10 the size of the press that does most of our stuff. But what it allows us to do is to have, you know, interesting batches of apples come in, and we can really, like, keep track of it and treat it in certain ways, and even pull off like a gallon, you know, if there's a particular apple that we want to test. So everything here is sort of geared on limited release and smaller scale. All of our Cider Club ciders have come out of here. Yeah.
Once again, all of this cider talk has us pretty thirsty. There's a lot to try at Shaxbury, and we're headed to the tasting room to sample all of it. David Dolganow, Shaxbury's other co-founder, is behind the bar.
You already
Do you already have the Dabinet?
I did.
Yeah.
Can I try just like the plain, like, dry and semi-dry?
This is the Dab.
Which loss of the boundary are you going to say?
15. 16's like close, but not quite there yet.
How long do you think that?
We're going to release it in like 2 weeks. So it's doing the secondary fermentation in the bottle, and then it needs to just kind of set, hang out for a little while, and then it's good to go. But I'm sure we'll be popping some bottles of it just to see later on. Or I bet if you went and asked one of the pros down there, they'd find one of those unmarked bottles and make it happen. So if you were to come in and order a flight today, we're doing the citrus spritz, and then dry, semi-dry, and finishing with Arlo. And then the limited releases that we're pouring today are a 15-month barrel-aged single varietal Dabinet cider that we just called the Dabinet, and our 2015 Lost and Found, which is our flagship cider made from wild apples foraged throughout the Champlain Valley. You guys know about that now.
Yeah, cool.
Can you tell us about the Arlo name?
Yeah. Arlito is named for Colin, one of the co-founders, Bulls. So Arlo is a Scottish Highlander cow, so long hair, long horns. They're also pretty short and like kind of stocky. We'll go visit Arlo tomorrow. And Arlo likes to eat apples, and he's a little cantankerous, just like Arlo the cider. So, and Arlo's unfiltered, and it's naturally carbonated, so it's can-conditioned, bone-dry, no residual sugar, and it's like a sour beer lover's cider.
With the promise of meeting Arlo in the morning and drinking unreleased Lost and Found at dinner tonight, we'll let Luke wrangle us back to Sunrise Orchards. When we get there, we're greeted by Chef Irene Lee of May May in Boston. Irene knows what a bunch of applesauce cider nerds really want, scallion pancakes. And she's great at teaching us how to make them. Her directions of flat pancake, snake, snail, flat pancake may be meant for Colin's 4-year-old son, but we're on the same level after all of that cider. Huge thanks to Brad Kaler of Windfall Orchards, Irene Lee of May May, and Luke, Colin, David, and Alex from Shaxbury Cider for an incredible weekend. We're so happy that the HRN team was included in Shax Camp and excited about all the great things going on in the cider wonderland of Vermont. This has been a special episode of HRN On Tour. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.